You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, September 7th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, no guest, too many stories, ladies and gentlemen. We'll briefly preview tonight's, what is it that we have tonight? Oh, the Republican debate. Stories on ongoing bank fraud, ongoing lack of prosecution of bank fraud. SEC still destroying investigation documents. This is stunning. Little preview of the job speech. We'll get to those anonymous stories. Horrible story about this guy who died from a toothache. All that and more. Let me get a little more sound here. Okay. Let me just start with this this email. Hi, Sam and Associates. This person, this is in response, of course, to someone who took some offense to what I had to say about Australia yesterday. Not that Australians were all descendants of criminals. They don't take offense to that, actually. Hi, Sam and Associates. In today's show, you made several mentions of an Australian miraculously signing up as a member. You have clearly forgotten the Australians who have signed up. Signed on right from the beginning. He, of course, Bo, is, of course, speaking of himself. In all seriousness, thanks to the continuing excellence of the Majority Report, keep up the good work, best and most entertaining U.S. political analysis on the internet. So there you have it, folks. Do you really need a descendant of bread thieves and... debtor scofflaws to tell you folks the value you have here in your own country to convince you to become a member of the Majority Report? You can sign up. It's easy at majority.fm. You get this half of the show and the better half of the show. And I don't know. Maybe Wednesdays we should just make all exclusively members. We'll see. I don't know if I'm ready to take that plunge. But you can, of course, support the show by going to donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. Basically, provide us with an echo chamber on your Facebook and Twitter feeds. We have gotten no complaints. I don't think we have a single example of anyone signing up for this and then canceling, which you can do at any time, of course. But my point being... that it's actually a service for you as well as a service for us. And same, of course, with JustCoffee.coop. Head over there, get your coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic if that's what you want. It's a co-op. And use the coupon code MAJORITY in the coupon box to get 10% off. Buy your junk through Amazon at our link at Majority FM. Just go there, get the link, bookmark it if you use Amazon a lot. We get some kickback. It's not a ton of money, but it pays for my morning coffee, almost, if I get a medium instead of a large. and your help is greatly appreciated. I want to start off with, well, first off, let me say this, that I watched President Obama's Labor Day speech yesterday after the program, and I watched Joe Biden's Labor Day speech after the program. They were the strongest endorsements of unions that I've heard from this administration. It was awkward when President Obama actually even mentioned Wisconsin. It was awkward, at least for me. And these are words and rhetoric I want to hear the president say, and that I've been looking for the president to say, at least provide some rhetorical support for this. Because frankly, from my perspective, we are somewhat effed, at least in the short to midterm. And as speaking as a leftist, and also, I think, frankly, the country, from any perspective, I mean, short of a corporatist, oligarchic, plutocratic perspective, I think we're effed in this country, at least in the short to midterm. But that doesn't mean that the 18, 20-year-olds, 25-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds won't have an opportunity in the future to rectify this. And it is very important that the framework be set and an understanding of what really is important if your goal is to benefit as many people as possible in this country, to share in the wealth of this country and the success of this country. And so this type of rhetoric is an essential part, I think, of being president. And for the most part, Obama has failed on that accord. There were some things in that speech that really annoyed me. At one point, he said, the Republicans like to think themselves as the tax cut party. Well, will they join me in cutting taxes for middle class Americans? He's basically trying to sell what's going to come up in his job speech tomorrow night, a continued moratorium on Social Security payroll taxes, or 2% of that payroll taxes. There, he's going to reportedly extend it to employers. This has very little effect on job creation. Very, very little effect on job creation. Theoretically, it puts a little bit more money into people's pockets, which theoretically increases demand, but it's a very, very blunt and muted instrument to stimulate the economy. There are other things that are being reported that he's going to talk about in his speech. We'll touch on it. There's no point in trying to anticipate what he's going to say. But I have to say, and I say this with regret, and I think it's problematic, that I'm watching this speech by President Obama and Vice President Biden. And had I seen this speech 2 years ago, I would have been very excited. And now I get I just don't know. I don't know that I can believe him. And I don't think that's productive. I mean, you know, in the course of our conversations yesterday after the program, or in the better half of the program, we had many, many phone calls that were talking about the desire to primary Obama, or asking the question, is Obama losing something that we should actually be ambivalent about? Because there are some out there who are making the calculation that 4 years of President Perry, or even President Romney, could bring us back to a point where we could begin to build a progressive infrastructure. I mean, you know, I know that was the theory with Nader. It didn't work out. But the economy is definitely going to be in the crapper for the next 3 or 4, maybe more years, maybe 6 years. It's going to be a different situation. But at the same time, you've got people who are actually going to pay for that calculation. I mean, we're in a dilemma, not unlike the Red Sox for many years. Red Sox would never have a rebuilding year. So they'd always get into the pennant race. And it would keep the fans happy, but they would never get all the way. And that is sort of the dilemma we have. I don't have the answer. But I heard this, in terms of the implications of what a President Perry would be, let me just give you an example. This story from ABC, a 24-year-old Cincinnati father. I think the guy had twins. Twenty-four-year-old Cincinnati father died from a tooth infection.
I heard about this.
Because he couldn't afford his medication. I guess it started where this guy, Kyle Willis's wisdom tooth, started hurting 3 or 4 weeks ago. Dentist told him it needed to be pulled, and he decided to forego the procedure because he was unemployed and had no health insurance. When his face started to swell and his head began to ache, which of course is a sign that you've got an infection and it's starting to spread, he went to the emergency room. He received prescriptions for antibiotics and pain medications. The guy couldn't afford both, and so he chose the pain medications. The tooth infection spread, causing his brain to swell. He died last week. And, you know, this is not the first of these stories. It was a couple of years ago. It was a 12-year-old kid who had the exact same situation, or more or less. He went through a couple of weeks of hospitalization. I can't remember how he paid for it, but his parents couldn't afford, didn't have health insurance. They couldn't afford the $80 extraction to pull out his tooth, or they didn't go to see a doctor because they didn't have insurance. They had lost his Medicaid benefits, and he couldn't afford the dental surgery, so the 12-year-old kid died. Kaiser Family Foundation reports that 33% of people surveyed in April skipped dental care or dental checkups because they couldn't afford them. A 2003 report by the U.S. Surgeon General found that 108 million Americans had no dental insurance, nearly 2.5 times the number who had no health insurance. That number is probably higher today. And the Affordable Care Act is actually going to help people like this, assuming it's intact by the time we get to 2014. An August report by the Commonwealth found that 72% of people who lost their health insurance when they lost their jobs said they skipped needed health care or did not fill prescriptions because of cost. People want to believe there's a safety net that catches all these people. Well, there isn't, says Dr. Glenn Stream, president-elect of the American Academy of Family Pediatricians. The Affordable Care Act will not deal with all of this, but it will deal with much of this. If you have President Perry, you're almost sure to have the Affordable Care Act go away. So when you make this determination, and it's not, you know, look, your determination may or may not impact the election whatsoever, one way or another. But when you make this determination, understand the calculation that you're making. More people will die. The calculation is, you know, if you think that, well, more people may die in a 4 or 6 year horizon versus less people will die in a 10 or 15 or 20 year horizon. Because maybe if you have President Perry for 4 years, then in 2017, 2016, Sam Cedar gets elected president of the United States, or Samantha Cedar, or some reasonable facsimile, and he or she pushes through single-payer health care, whatever it is, stops killing people around the world, whatever it is. So that's the calculation. And but one thing that's not being discussed, and I'll tell you something, Buddy Romer is, you know, I don't know where on the spectrum he is politically. He is like the worst of blue dog Democrats, I suppose. The only difference is this guy is one of those libertarian conservative types. I'm not even sure of all of his policies, frankly. But he was on Rachel Maddow last night. He was on The Daily Show, I think, the night before. And this I found extremely impressive.
In some ways, your candidacy seems founded on the basis that we have an electoral sickness. All these other things are symptoms to something that is sick in our electoral system. What is that?
You can't tackle the jobs problem, the budget problem, the tax problem, or America rising without tackling the first problem, money and politics. It is corrupt. It is institutionally corrupt. They spend their time getting big checks from big special interests. It's the special interests, John, who write the tax code. You can't read it. It doesn't work for America. It hurts jobs. We give them away. They're being stolen by unfair trade. And nobody does anything. You know why? Corporations have never made more money than they are right now. They wrote the tax code, and they really don't give a damn about the rest of America.
I thought that was pretty impressive. We're going to take a break. When we come back, there's a really interesting piece out by a former Republican staffer. We'll talk about that briefly, and we'll head in into the preview of the job speech, a disturbing story of just how the EPA rollback on the ozone rules was, I guess, the process behind that. And some also equally disturbing stories about the banks. You're getting fucked. All right, we'll be right back after this. So there was a piece out the other day by Mike Lofgren, who was a veteran congressional staffer. He worked for Republican legislators on defense and budget issues for 30 years. He's written a piece. You can check it out in Truth Out. Goodbye to all that. Reflections of a GOP operative who left the cult. I'm not going to get into that full piece today. I'm trying to get him for a guest. But in the piece, he argues that today's Republicans, and this is not going to come as a surprise to you. This is something that, frankly, I spent a lot of time arguing back in 2006, 2007, 2005, 2004, 2008. Today's Republicans believe they're better off if government as a whole is shown to fail. Not just the Democratic administration. I can tell you that there are people in activist circles, liberal activist circles, who have been arguing that we need to be careful not to attack government, but this government, this administration, as opposed to government. Because fundamentally, government as an institution can and should work for the benefit of people. And it's the only way we can organize. You know, I have this argument with Tim Carney on Rattigan's show all the time, where he's like, government's corrupt by corporate influence. So the solution is to shrink government. What?
Hey, what happened?
If you shrink government, all that you would do is give corporations more influence over government. The question is, how do you strengthen government? How do you shield it from those type of corporate interests? And Buddy Romer seems to have a pretty good idea. I mean, I'll tell you something. If I contribute any money to a presidential candidate this year, it may be him. I would probably only do it while he's in the primary because I would like to see his voice. He is not going to be on the stage tonight because he's only polling around 1% right now. But I would like to see him get up and say that in front of all those Republicans. That would be very helpful to have in the conversation. I may give him $10, not monthly. He's not doing an hour and a half of programming on a daily basis. It's not that good. I mean, what do you just do? 5 minutes on Jon Stewart? I'll give him $10. He's still ahead of the game. So he explains, Lofgren, that Republican hardliners might have seemed to have lost the debt ceiling showdown. At least in terms of polls, they're less popular than the Democrats. But in the long view, Lofgren says, unpopularity for anyone in Congress, including their party's leaders, helps Republicans. Undermining Americans' belief in their own institutions of self-government remains a prime GOP electoral strategy. It builds a nihilistic suspicion of any public effort, from road building to Medicare to schools. And he's absolutely right. Of course, the strategy is clear. They want the American public to be disgusted with government. They want the American public to see the institution is not working. So when they criticize the post office or the DMV or whatever it is, the most random, seemingly non sequitur criticism of anything you can imagine, there is a purpose behind it. And that purpose is to destroy the fabric of trust between, and not even trust, destroy the fabric, the belief that government can service people. Because the next step they take is government's an obstacle. Reagan's famous, let's get government out of the way and let the free enterprise just shower gold down upon us. Like a golden shower, as Catherine Harris would say. And I have to say, I actually said that pilot season 6-7 years ago. I think I said it's like a, actually, you know what? Actually, I think that was in the Comedy Lab show I did in 93. So it was like a field of gold, like a gold, like a shower of gold, like a golden shower. Anyways. So James Fallows was writing about this, and he got an email from another congressional staffer who used to work for moderate blue dog Democrat. And he writes, one thing that especially resonated with me about Mike's piece is the importance of low information voters. The mainstream media absolutely fails to understand how little attention average Americans really pay to what goes on in all forms of government. You people understand that you represent less than 1%. You're probably in the top 1 percentile of savvy and intelligence when it comes to government and politics. Of people who don't work in politics. Maybe even higher than that, people who don't work in politics. Not just because you listen to this show, but this show is both symptomatic and it's probably a cyclical relationship. And he goes on to say, during our 2008 race, our pollster taught me, it's hard to believe it took me 24 years to learn this, that the average voter spends only 5 minutes thinking about for whom to vote for Congress. All the millions of dollars of TV ads, all the thousands of robocalls and door knocks, and it all comes down to having a message that will stick in voters' minds during the 5 minutes before they walk into the voting booth. Now, I imagine for president, they actually spend like 15 minutes. The media likes to call this group independents, which implies they think so long and deeply about issues they refuse to be constrained by the philosophy of either party. There may be a couple of people out there who fit that definition, but those are not the persuadable voters campaigns are trying to capture. Every campaign is trying to develop its candidate into an easy-to-remember slogan that makes him or her more appealing than the other guy. Actually, because negative campaigning is so effective, they are more often trying to portray the opponent as more objectionable. I guess I'll vote for the crook because at least he won't slash my Medicare. So that gives you an indication of both the state of our politics, the mindset of the Obama administration, and most candidates for Congress, and the Republican Party, which is why we're in such a quagmire. Obama's going to make his speech tomorrow night, and it is reportedly going to be a $300 billion jobs package. Now, of course, here's how this goes, right? $300 billion jobs package. Supposed to impress the liberals, the Republicans will run around saying he's spending another $300 billion. And, of course, $170 billion of it is for extended unemployment benefits and the extension of the payroll tax cut. So I don't know what the breakdown of about half about it is, payroll tax cut. Like I say, these are not – unemployment insurance is actually pretty good from a stimulative standpoint. Payroll tax cut, not so much, a little bit. They won't create jobs directly. It may stimulate the economy slightly. There's another $30 billion in tax credits for hiring the unemployed, which would be helpful, but it's not that much money. And again, the bottom line is, in this environment, if it is a close enough call that you're thinking about hiring somebody and you're only going to do so if you get some slight tax advantage, chances are you're not going to hire anybody anyways. You must perceive more demand. Either you must perceive that you're going to have more demand for your product in the near term, or you're experiencing it right now and you can't handle it. There was a report out by McClatchy, not necessarily a scientific survey, but they went around and spoke to a lot of different small businesses across the country. When they asked what is preventing you from hiring, nobody said nobody said regulations, and nobody said taxes. It was all a function of demand. If my business is up, if it's picking up, I'll hire more. If it's not, and I don't think it's going to, I won't. Period. And so the remaining $100 billion, about half of which is going to be for infrastructure building, which is more helpful. And he was talking about that in his Labor Day speech. But what we're going to see also is going to be a rollback on some of those nasty regulations that really aren't hurting job creation, but will make the Chamber of Commerce much, much happier. The Consumer Financial Bureau nominee to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, his name is not Elizabeth Warren, or otherwise known as Richard Cordray. He was her deputy when she was setting up the agency. He said that he would use the agency's bigger and more flexible toolbox to police consumer financial laws and would make judicious use of needlessly acrimonious lawsuits to enforce financial regulations. And he's going to streamline and cut back on the mountain of regulations that has grown up over the last 30 years. I mean, you know, simplifying the regulations is fine as long as they're more stringent. And it's unclear what that means. And of course, the Republicans welcome this, but they said we're not going to confirm him anyways because we want the whole agency destroyed. So he will not be confirmed. But this is the mantra that we're hearing from the administration. And story in The Hill today. Obama's surprise move to block an ozone regulation from the Environmental Protection Agency followed immense pressure from industry trade associations, which made numerous personal appeals to White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley. Now, look, there's nothing illegal or even unprecedented for the Chief of Staff of the President to sit in on meetings by the Office of Management and Budget's Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. This is Cass Sunstein's place, where he's like, you know, yeah, too much regulation. Yeah, liberals are too caught up in it. But he's sitting there meeting with people like Cal Dooley of the American Chemistry Council, Jay Timmons of the National Association of Manufacturers, John Engler of the Business Roundtable, Bruce Joston, chief lobbyist for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and American Petroleum Institute President Jack Girard, who was very, very happy about this move because they care so much about little asthmatic babies. The Business Roundtable wrote to Daley directly on July 15th and urged him to void the proposed ozone regulation. Schneider, this is Johanna Schneider, Executive Director of External Relations for the Business Roundtable, said Daley's attention to the rule made it a top priority at the White House. Because, you know, Bill Daley is such an expert on what creates asthma in little babies and has so much more scientific knowledge about what is good for your lungs than the Scientific Advisory Board of the EPA. So this was by no means in any way a political decision by the Obama administration. It moved to the top of the issue. It moved the issue to the top of the agenda for the president. That is what happens when you have a White House chief of staff getting involved, Schneider said. She must be so happy. Now, think about this. This is all a 6-week period. I mean, bam, 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 right? They don't even have to do this. We don't have to make the call 6 months out. No. We can wait until Lisa Jackson gets out there and continually assures people that the ozone layer won't be ozone emissions will be set to safe standards based on scientific data. And then last minute we can go, oh, you know what? I'm just going to text Bill Daley. Beep, 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 beep. And again, what we see is the right-wing frame of government regulation being an obstacle to the free market and to the economic flourishment of all. And this is what is so disappointing about the Obama administration. And really understand When I say this is about politics, I don't think this is about electoral politics. They have to know this is not going to change the rhetoric from whoever they're running against. Rick Perry or Mitt Romney is still going to say the Obama administration is killing us with regulations. And then apologists for this administration will say, no, 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 they're not. They've got less regulations. They don't have no regulations. When I say this is about politics, this is about money. Remember that staffer who said it's about convincing those low information voters with those advertising campaigns they see so they can think 5 minutes before they go in who they're going to pull the lever for. And we were talking about this on the better half of the show yesterday. The Obama administration, the Obama campaign, is simply going to raise so much money that they're going to hope to bury their opponent. And when they do favors like this for the American Petroleum Council or whoever it is, the National Association of we're going to poison as many Americans as it takes for us to make a huge profit, he's going to get money. And so when I hear Buddy Romer, who may be a freak in many other ways, may not be, say that he's going to take a principled stand and only... and accept no corporate money. And he talks about this. And I think he's, you know, the thing he said to Maddow was that, you know, as a conservative, I believe that money is speech. So don't get too carried away with this guy. But he said, you as a liberal believe that money should be restricted in politics. I'm for full disclosure. If we can't have restriction, let's have full disclosure. And I think that's an important voice to be heard in our political, in the political mix. Do I think he has a chance of winning? No. Could he make things interesting? Yes. And so, like I say, if I'm going to give 10 bucks, if I'm going to give 10 bucks to any presidential candidate, that's who it's going to be. I may vote for Obama. I probably will vote for Obama. But I ain't giving a I'm not giving him a buck. Not a dollar. Not a dollar of my money will go to President Obama. I'm sorry. Like I say, he may have my vote, but he ain't going to get my money. Meanwhile, a story I covered, I think it was with Peter Mouget last week. The SEC basically imposed new rules through Dodd-Frank that would allow shareholders to create their own slate of board of directors. Right now you have board of directors of corporations. It's sort of a closed loop. When they leave, when their term is up, they propose who's going to replace them. And this is the problem. I keep citing that interview I did with Bill Lozanik. Corporations have lost sight of their mission. They have CEOs and board of directors whose interests are not aligned with the long-term health of the corporation. Their interests are, how can I make as much money from my stock options as I possibly can? That does not necessarily align with the best interests of the corporation in the long term. You can make decisions that will have short-term and mid-term, based upon when your options are available, when you can actually sell them, exercise them, I should say. You can make decisions that will benefit your stock, but won't necessarily benefit the long-term health of the corporation. And it certainly won't help its function to provide a product or a service that is helpful to society. And so one of the means in which to deal with this problem is to bring in other voices onto the board of directors. But now the system is so closed that it's virtually impossible to do to bring on anybody who isn't already a crony of the existing and the remaining board of directors. And so Dodd-Frank SEC was hoping to change this just to make it a little bit easier for shareholders to nominate their own candidate for board of directors. Well, apparently there was a court decision, which I mentioned, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, invalidating the initiative. And the SEC chairman, Mary Shapiro, said late Tuesday that the agency will not appeal that decision. It's a defeat for institutional shareholders such as pension funds and labor unions, which argued that greater democracy in the boardroom would make corporate leaders more accountable. Boards are generally self-perpetuating. They decide whose names appear on the official corporate ballot. So there you have it. The SEC is going to try other means in which to deal with this, but, you know, so the judiciary does matter, folks. There you go. It would be nice if Obama actually filled some of these vacant judiciary spots, but who knows? One more story before we go into the better half. Oh, I should say, just to give you a heads up, the FAA reauthorization fight is going to come up again, the long-term one. And we're going to post on the blog an ad that the CWA, is it the CWA? Which union did
CWA.
It?
CWA.
Was it the not the communication? Let me pull that up. Not sure which union it was, but...
Yeah, that's the Communication Workers of America.
They put up that ad. It's interesting. Is it about and it's about Delta though, right?
Yeah.
And it basically they use audio from the interview I did, I believe, either with Laura Clausen or with the head of the communications workers that I did for Ring of Fire. I can't remember. I think it's from this show. And so we put it on the blog. That's fun. I like it. No, I just got an IM from Josh. Did they pay you? No, they didn't. And I don't want that. Listen, I appreciate the fact that they thought the interview was worthy of them using it in an ad. In fact, if anything, I'm going to sue them for using any other audio in the ad. They should only use me in the ad.
Someone from over there must be listening because how?
Well, yeah, I would imagine many people are, and so I it was weird because I stumbled across the ad. I was reading a piece, I think it was Greg Sargent's blog in the Washington Post, and I clicked on the ad. Will this be good sound for the show? And there's graphics up front, so the sound is not necessarily would have been difficult to describe. And I listen, I'm like, that sounds familiar. It's me. So one more story on the SEC, and then we will go to the better half of the show. You'll recall the story that Matt Taibbi did and spoke at length on this program about. The SEC, Securities Exchange Commission again, was destroying evidence in investigations, was closing down investigations prematurely and destroying evidence systematically, destroying the majority of their evidence. Particularly when they got leads, even if it wasn't something that they thought they could make a case, they weren't keeping any evidence of that, so they couldn't see any patterns over the years of certain behavior by certain companies or corporations or whatever it is. And so a year after it was warned that it might be violating federal law, you'll remember the story involved a whistleblower who contacted the National Archives. And it said, like, hey, are you aware that we're destroying all this information? And the National Archives and Records Administration said, no, you're not supposed to be doing that. We had a deal for years, since 1993, that you'll save all of that stuff. And so they sent a letter back in August of 2010 saying, hey, remember that deal and the federal law that says you shouldn't destroy that information? Yeah, start not doing it. Start not doing it now. Start complying with the law. Well, a year after it was warned that it might be violating federal law, the SEC is still breaking the law. a lawyer in the agency's enforcement division has alleged. In addition, the purging of files has involved a wider range of investigative documents than previously reported. This is according to a signed statement by the enforcement lawyer. The enforcement division policy results in the destruction of about 75% of the documents the staff generates or receives in formal investigations. This is according to Darcy Flynn, the whistleblower. Of those, the SEC should be keeping about 70%. Without legal justification, the enforcement division has given its staff a green light to discard all internal emails when investigations are closed. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think they simply gave them a green light, or they actually said, this way? And I say, they put this in the passive. Yeah, we didn't crack down on anybody who was doing it. As opposed to like, yeah, destroy it. Most of the case documents produced by staff are currently be destroyed unless they are considered to be formal memoranda, Flynn wrote. So there you have it. It continues. Don't know why that policy hasn't ended. It's the law. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the show. You can call me, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Oh, and hold on, pause the music. There was one other thing. I have a question for people. And I was invited to speak on two panels for the Take Back the American Dream by the Campaign for America's Future. It's a conference October 5th, I think it is. It's 3 to the 5th or something. And I was going to go down there under the auspices of Ring of Fire, do some interviews for them, get them to pay for the transport and hotel and whatnot. And it turns out there's no official radio row there. So Ring of Fire is not going to go, not going to pay to send me down there. I wasn't going to go. I was telling my wife, because I would have to take a 2:30 a.m. train to get down there for the two panels in the morning and then take a train back. And it would have been just too tricky. I would have been just too fried to do a show afterwards and wouldn't have had time to set up and or pay whatever it was, the $270 for a hotel, I guess, at the hotel at the place, whatever it is. And so I told Nikki I wasn't going to do this. And she said, well, are people going to be disappointed? I said, they don't even know about it. She said, well, what do you think people would want you to go? And I said, I don't know. And she said, why don't you ask people if they want you to go and they want to donate to you to go, then you go. And if they don't, then you don't. So I said, okay, yes, dear, whatever you say, of course. So, folks, if you want me to go, I will broadcast from the Take Back the American Dream conference. I will do a show from there. I will get the audio of the panels. And I probably will be the most obnoxious person on all the panels saying the problem we have is the rich in this country and that we're involved in a class war. And that all of you who are here because of your donors, they're the problem. Or their buddies are the problem. Or something to that effect. It could be rather uncomfortable. Because I've never gone to this conference because I've perceived it to be sort of veal pen-ish, but maybe it's not. I know that, you know, they're doing the Take Back the American Dream. They're working with Van Jones, who's got this new organization, and so it could be good, it could be interesting, but you know, it's up to you. So if you want, what you can do is, and we'll put the link in the blog post, donate however much you want, but put a nickel on the end of it. So if it's $5, give me $5.05. So if I end up not getting $500 to go, I will refund all of the donations. So put the 05 cents on there. But don't donate 5 cents. So donate like a minimum of $1. And if I get $500, I'll go. If I don't get $500, I'll give you your money back. So it's up to you. You got to do it quick because I don't want to get the people pissed off who I said I would do the panels. One is the Progressive Breakfast, and one is a panel with Digby, set up by Nicole Sandler. So it could be interesting. And I'll get recordings of it and make them play it. I'll play it on the show. Okay, so you can go to majority.fm if you're interested. If not, it's up to you. Power to the people is what I say. Tonight will be the Republican debate. I'll be live tweeting it, I'm sure. I'm actually interested in to see Rick Perry, just to see how much Michelle Bachmann goes after him. Okay, join me on the better half of the show coming up. Banks took $6 billion in what appears to be fraudulent kickback schemes with mortgage insurance. And in the better half of the show, you'll find out just why the fuck no one's been prosecuted. That and other stories. Oh, the anonymous story, too. I'll get to that. We'll be right back after this.